half with pipe cutters. They come in 24 inch length, 2 12 inch lengths of that, and I put the caps on the end, the closed caps that they normally cap off the pipe on each end. Before I put the caps on, however, I had to glue them, but before I did that, I drilled holes in both ends. I put stainless steel hardware on both ends, eye hooks, eye bolts, with the stainless steel nuts and washers on the inside and the outside, and to put it all together, glued it together, it made a beautiful insulator, and it's very professional looking, and I have four of those flying in the sky right now here, my two dipoles, and I used similar arrangements. Let me drop. If need be, and I was going to use a bound in the center, although they do sell professional bounds already made of the same material and the bound inside, if I were to build a bound, I would do the same thing, but instead of course having it horizontal, I would mount that vertical in the center. But anyway, those PVC bounds are found, but the large PVC insulators on both ends are so professional and so rugged, and they last for a very, very long time. And I usually use number 10 or number 8 solid wire for the actual conductor of the antenna. Back to you, Dick.
Parabolic dish reflector. There are guys who have used the aluminum sled design that looks like a flying saucer. They've used that as a parabolic reflector. There's all kinds of things in the hardware store you can use if you're smart enough. And one of the things I enjoy doing, let me grab a call. When I go into a more rural area, like when I was in Utica, New York, working for Rome Air Development Center a few years ago, 10, 15 years ago now, they had a hardware store that was located in a building that was four stories high or six stories high. It used to be a knitting mill, and so four separate stories of hardware stores, and each story was about an acre of floor space. My goodness, did they have stuff. All kinds of farm machinery and whatever. And you'd be amazed how many of those things are useful in the ham radio world. So keep your eyes open. The next person on our list was Hal, K6DPZ. A little later on, now maybe you and I will have a further discussion on length of transmission line versus standing wave ratio. There's a lot more to the story than first meets the eye. Over to you, Hal, K6DPZ. Wait for the four beeps, K2RAW in the TechNet. I was very sure that Hal signed in earlier. One more call for Hal. K6DPZ, K2RAW, go ahead, Hal. Okay, Bob was next. W2OSR. One of our board members. Go right ahead, Bob. How's the world treating you these days? You're sounding good. W2OSR, K2RAW in the TechNet. W2OSR, K2RAW, are you there, Bob? Hello, anybody?
We're still out here, Dick, don't worry.
Glad to hear that. I was getting a little worried. Afraid I was talking to myself. So often when I'm using my full duplex system, I set it wrong, and I'm listening to my transmitter frequency instead of the receive frequency from the repeater. And you can be talking to yourself, and it's an intelligent conversation, but nobody contributes. Okay, Hal or Bob, either one of you guys there, K6DPZ or W2OSR, K2RAW. Okay, maybe they'll come back a little later. So, John, as you can see, it's confusing. When you measure line to ground, you can get a false impression of what's going to happen line to line, depending on whether you're in one of the five boroughs of New York City, which quite often run on real three-phase power, two of those phases coming into a private home. Whereas out here on Nassau and Suffolk, only one phase comes into the house. Same number of wires, but it's wired differently. KC2WTB. Hey, John, what kind of exotic questions have you gotten from your mailbag this week? K2RAW. You got it, John.
Boy, Dick, which is more popular or more used, system on Long Island or the system they use in Queens? Which is used more in the United States?
I'm not sure. But if I had to make a guess, the Long Island system, the 180-degree phase shift, one single phase coming into the house, I think dominates. I'll bet you that's used 80% of the time. The so-called three-phase system where two of the phases comes into the house, in a couple of metro areas, it's used, but I don't think it's popular in the rural areas. That's my guess. But I'll bet you if we do the right kind of an email or a web search, a Google search or a Wikipedia search, we'll probably find out about which is more popular. Each has its advantages, and so there's not a clear advantage where everybody would go over to one versus the other, but I think the Long Island Standard is the more popular, is my best guess, Rich. KC2WGB, K2RAW, go with your mailbag, John.
Alrighty. Good evening, Paul. Good evening, Dick. Are you on the net? Yeah, I've got a couple of good questions here. Let me know the drop and I'll get the first question. Okay. Well, this one's coming from Pennsylvania. gentleman has an RF meter, and he is measuring the pattern radiation of his antenna, the radiation pattern of his antenna. And the field strength meter is working fine. He has two rigs. Both of them are 50 watts. He's working with 2 meters. He wants to know why, when he puts one radio on and tees it up, he'll read maybe, I think, 18 microvolts out there. And when he kicks the second one on at the same time, it doesn't double. It only goes to maybe 19. Sometimes it doesn't even go that high. You'd like to know the reason why. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Alright, so he's measuring the pattern of an antenna. He's got a pair of transmitters, each 50 watts. A big variable that wasn't told. How is he combining the two transmitters? Is each transmitter going to a separate antenna?
Yes.
Whoa. I was a little bit afraid he's going to be combining the two transmitters with a T connector, as some guys have done. Very not recommended. Or some guys, if they're smarter, will combine the two with a real hybrid combining network. But two separate antennas and two separate transmitters. Boy, there's a zillion different ways that can go. Let me drop it. Whenever you feed power to more than one antenna or more than one transmitter, vector-wise, three-dimensional space, you'd be amazed what you're doing, how complicated it is. You don't think so, but whenever you're feeding power on the same frequency to two separate antennas, you have generated an electronically steerable phased array. If there was one single transmitter with a power divider feeding the two antennas, now you're guaranteeing that the signal going to the two antennas is identical in amplitude and identical in phase, and you think everything would be adding by 2 to 1. Yes and no. It's a function now of not the power and not the gain of the antennas per se, but the phase angle. If the piece of cable going to one antenna is longer than the other, and if in the worst case situation one antenna is fed 180 degrees out of phase compared to the other, and you're standing off in space broadside to the two antennas, you would be in the position of a null. You would in theory measure zero. You go off to the end where you're looking at the two antennas, one behind the other, you might see a great big peak, because that's what happens with a phased array. If I've got two antennas mounted a half wavelength apart, one is north of the other, and I make a measurement to the east, and the two antennas are fed out of phase, I'll see a null, and I now walk around to the north, I'll see a great big peak, or walk around to the south, I'll see a great big peak. And that, of course, is confusing, because it's now adding what really happens at the point of reception, what Mother Nature does. Let me drop it. Good common sense would be that Mother Nature adds the power from the first transmitter and the first antenna, adds it to the power from the second transmitter and the second antenna, adds those two signals together at the receiving site, and that's what good common sense would lead you to believe. Absolutely not. Mother Nature does not think in power. She thinks in voltage. Ham radio operators think in power. I got a 50-watt transmitter, and whether or not that 50-watt transmitter is making 127 volts RMS at 144 megacycles, we don't talk that way. And by the way, that's not the exact number, but you know what I mean. We don't talk in voltage. We talk in power and sometimes in S units and sometimes in dB and dBm, but we don't talk in volts. Mother Nature thinks in volts. So you take the voltage that the first antenna through the path length of free space into that receiving antenna, you add that voltage to the second antenna, its voltage sent through free space going into the receiving antenna. You add those two voltages together in a vector manner. That vector manner means I'm adding the magnitude of the voltage, including the phase angle, which is a little bit similar to our earlier discussion on Con Ed power versus LIPA power. Many places in Con Ed power where two separate phases come into the house 120 degrees apart, you add them in a vector manner, and you come up with 208 volts line to line. You take like the exact same looking wires coming into your house on Long Island when you're running on LIPA power where there's 180 degrees of phase difference between the two, and you measure line to line. You don't measure 208, you measure something close to 235 or 240 because of the phase angle. Let me drop. Your RF sensing meter does that. So how long is the cable going to the two? How long is the path length between the two antennas and the receiving site? All of these change the phase angle, magnitude of voltage, and so on. That's on the assumption that the two transmitters, two antennas are being fed from the same transmitter and a power divider. Now you take two separate transmitters. Let's assume now that each transmitter is running T down, TW, no modulation of any kind. And each transmitter has a reference oscillator in there that runs this phase lock loop. Even though you have set the dials at both transmitters to 146.250 megahertz, and you think they're on the exact same frequency, absolutely not. Two thoroughly independent transmitters that you think are on the same frequency, no matter how accurately you set those reference oscillators. One reference oscillator at 10 megacycles is going to be 3 hertz higher than the other. When you go through the phase lock loop and all the multiplications going on, the real frequency you're transmitting might be 50 or 100 hertz. One transmitter is higher than the other, even though they're set to the exact same number on the dial. That means the two separate signals from the two separate antennas going to the receiving antenna are going in phase and out of phase 100 times per second if there was a 100 hertz difference in the frequency between the two transmitters. And now, if each of those transmitters is an FM transmitter, let me drop. Each of those is an FM transmitter, which has a PL tone, 136.5 hertz of FM modulation, 136.5 hertz of rate, plus or minus the maybe a 1KC or whatever the PL tone deviation is. Each individual transmitter is going up and down in frequency because of the PL oscillator. They're going up and down in frequency a little bit because of the noise picked up by the microphone. When you push the push-to-talk mic switch, still the microphone is picking up the noise. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why each individual transmitter is instantaneously on a different frequency and a different phase from the other transmitter. And now that meter of yours out there is trying to take those instantaneous vectors, every millisecond they're going in phase and out of phase, and try to add them together and come up with some kind of an average of the reading. As you can see, a very simple looking block diagram of your system on a piece of paper, when you actually measure what's really going on in the real world, a hell of a lot more is happening than first meets the eye. Let me drop. So, because of them being in phase and out of phase half of the time, if both signals were exactly 50 watts, antennas are exactly broadside to you, side by side, but they're broadside to your receiving site, both antennas have the exact same gain, both antennas have the exact same distance to the receiving site, you think you've made everything the same, but because of the minor differences in frequency between the two transmitters, what's really happening is the two transmitters are spending a certain percentage of their time every second, every millisecond, in phase, a certain percentage of the time out of phase, practically going through that. If there's a 100 hertz difference in the transmitters, they're going in phase and out of phase 100 times per second. And now, you add that together as some kind of an average. The average turns out to be quadrature. In other words, plus and minus 90 degrees out of phase is going to be the average when they're really, one is rotating compared to the other on a vector diagram. Therefore, a pair of 50 watt transmitters in that experience would look like not 100 watts, not 50 watts, something like 75. So you're going to get crazy numbers. So in order to really measure antenna pattern of two separate antennas, the first thing you got to do is use one single signal generator, somehow divide the power, which could be as simple as a T connector, but somehow you divide the power and one single transmitter goes to the two separate antennas. Now you stand a chance of measuring that antenna pattern because it's a stable pattern. When those two transmitters are on slightly different frequencies, there's one more thing I want to show you here that's going to be amazing to you. Let me drop. When you've got two antennas that are more than a half wavelength apart, and you feed them at the exact same frequency, you are making an antenna pattern that has the equivalent of a number of fingers in space, depending on how many half wavelengths is the separation between the two antennas. You've got a number of fingers in space. When you feed the two antennas from two separate transmitters that are on slightly different frequency, you are doing electronic steering of a phased array. Those fingers in space are now rotating around those antennas. If those two frequencies out of the two transmitters are 100 hertz different out of 146 megacycles, 100 hertz of difference, those fingers in space are wrapping around the antenna 100 times per second. You've got a sweeping antenna pattern that's moving so fast that your sensing meter is not going to see it. If you had a crystal detector on the sensing antenna, and you ran that into an oscilloscope, you'd see a very interesting waveform as those fingers in space were sweeping by you. You see what's happening here, John, how much more that first meets the eye? KT2WGB, K2LAW in the tech net. Question.
Yes, I do think. All right, wait a minute, I think I heard one. To HGN, when you have an in-phase and out-of-phase, you have a constellation. You have a dead zero. And to HGN.
And you two guys doubled with each other, but I think I know what Wes is trying to ask. When they're in-phase and out-of-phase, and you think you're going to get a null, you're going to get a null if and only if the two transmitters are identical in power, identical in frequency, meaning the exact same transmitter, and you've carefully made a null by way of carefully adjusting the signal going to the two antennas to be 180 degrees out of phase, broadside to the two antennas, they're out of phase, and yes, you're going to see a null. That null will not be there if the transmitters are slightly different in frequency. When you go, if the two antennas are north and south of each other, and you're making a measurement to the east, you'll see a null. When you go north of the north antenna or south of the south antenna with your sensing antenna, because of the path length difference from that point of view, you're adding another phase angle. When you increase the number of wavelengths between you and antenna, you're adding phase. So what you think is out of phase of two antennas, when you look at them end fire, due north or due south, become back in phase. And you see a great big signal in that direction. So if you measure the antenna pattern of that signal setup that I just described, you might have a great big lobe to the north, a great big lobe to the south, a null to the east, and a null to the west, when you think you've adjusted the two antennas 180 degrees out of phase. What's magic about signal going into two separate antennas is you're putting power into two antennas. Let me drop. Power really means a certain rate at which you're putting energy. If you're putting 1 watt into each antenna, it really means you're putting 1 joule of energy per second into each antenna. You're putting real energy into two antennas. And once energy has been created, it cannot be destroyed. You can change it to another form, put it into a dummy mode, you can turn it into heat. But you radiate real energy into space. You cannot cancel that energy. You'll create a null in certain chosen directions. In some other direction, there is no null. You put 50 watts into two antennas that are separated a reasonable distance. You are putting 100 watts of energy into space. Even if they're out of phase, you cannot cancel. You can cancel in certain directions. In other directions, it will not be a cancel, and there is 100 watts going into space, no matter what phase angle you put into those two antennas. I know that's opposite of common sense. N2XJN, K2LAW.
Yes, Christian, I understand that, but let's say in the point of definite null, we put a sensor or an
antenna. Big antenna. What time things it is that are cells are receiving for? It could be connected to the oscilloscope, it could be connected anywhere. Now, we try not to play with 100 Hz, but we try to play with the square 1 Hz. Or 2 Hz, say. So we adjust the frequency difference of the multiplication, whatever it is. In here, we have actually elimination of the fingers. I know I have probably explained it, but as you see the fingers circulating, actually, did you notice that the fingers could disappear for the no point? The energy didn't. And of course, funny thing would be if I would, say, take the energy from this pole and feed back to one of the transmitters.
If I had two precise frequency-synthesized signal generators, both running from the exact same reference oscillator at 10 megacycles, for instance, and I adjust the two signal generators to be 1 hertz different, and I've adjusted the cable length between the two signal generators and the two antennas so that one cable is a half wavelength longer than the other. I've created 180 degrees of phase shift by cable length. So I fed the two antennas out of phase. One antenna is north of the other, north and south this way. And I'm making the measurement to the east. And I'm putting it into any kind of instrumentation you like. But there's 1 hertz of difference. I will watch that meter wave back and forth, one cycle per second. It'll come up to a peak, go down to a no, back to a peak, one time, one cycle per second. I will watch that peak move because the two signal generators are on a different frequency, 1 hertz different at 2 meters. So the signals, on half the cycle, they're in phase, half the cycle, they're out of phase because of the 1 hertz difference. Therefore, at that point of measurement, I will watch the receive power, the receive voltage, the receive energy, whatever you want to call it. I will watch it go up and down through a cycle 1 time per second. That displacement of those two antennas, because of the physical displacement of the antennas, let me pick a number, they're 3 wavelengths apart. The 3 wavelengths apart spacing means that as a phased array, either omnidirectional ground plane antennas, I'm making at least 3 or more fingers in space because of the displacement of the two antennas. Because of the 1 hertz difference, those fingers are waving in space. Not because of the repeater. The fingers in space are because of the instantaneous phase difference between the two antennas. Because one antenna is fed a signal 1 hertz higher in frequency than the other at the RF frequency, 146 megs, for instance, 1 hertz higher, means that the phase angle between the two antennas is rotating between 0 and 360 degrees once every second. Each antenna, when it's fed at 0 degrees, 90 degrees, 180 degrees, 270 degrees, 360 degrees, a phase difference between the two antennas makes an entirely different pattern in space. I'm calling those fingers. Those fingers in space will be waving by you 1 hertz per second. All those fingers will wave by you if there's 1 hertz of difference between the two frequencies. N2XJM, H-U-R-I-W in the
TechNet. The question is, could you have a controllable way of maneuvering with the fingers?
Could I have a controllable way of blank fingers? I can't understand that word. Spell it out for me.
Would you be able to control the fingers' position?
You're asking me, can I electronically control the pattern of a phased array antenna? Absolutely. If I'm smart enough to feed both antennas from the exact same signal generator, no difference in frequency. And now I shift the phase. I've got a knob where I can advance or retard the phase of one antenna versus the other. I am sweeping those fingers in space as I operate that phase knob. That's how an electronically steered phased array antenna works. You vary the phases.
Now, weapon guiding system or weapon today.
As you advance or retard that phase, that's what does the electronic pattern generation. N2XJN, K2LAW.
Right, and now you have a weapon guiding system, or you have a weapon disorientation system. Am I right?
There's a zillion ways that you use an electronically steered antenna, a phased array antenna. To be able to aim the antenna at a particular target is one way. To control how well you receive a signal in certain directions versus another direction is another way. If you are smart enough with a phased array antenna that has enough individual elements to it, you can, with the so-called Widrow algorithm, W-I-D-R-O-W, this is a guy who, roughly 1968, wrote a whole series of articles. If you're smart enough of using the Widrow algorithm, you can generate a whole bunch of fingers in space, in three-dimensional space. You can steer the fingers in azimuth and elevation. You can steer individual fingers into individual directions. You can steer knobs into individual directions. And if you've got enough adaptability to your phased array electronically steered antenna, you can, let me drop. You can simultaneously generate a number of fingers in space and a number of knobs in space such that the fingers in space are looking at all of the desirable transmitters. The nulls in space are in the directions of all of the undesirable transmitters, like jammers. And therefore, in three-dimensional space, if you've got the right equipment, you can maximize the signal-to-noise ratio of all the good guys versus all the bad guys. Electronically steered antennas can do all of that, and can do all of that dynamically in microseconds. You can steer that beam in microseconds when you're doing it electronically. It gives you a hell of a lot of capability if you're smart enough to do it. I didn't say it's easy. When it comes to phased arrays, ham radio operators have made very little use of it to date. But maybe that's going to change. N2XJN, K2LAW.
Yeah, I wonder why Iran was able to take out of the sky American drone and eventually make a fun of Americans afterwards, and Turkey.
If you now work in the business of electronic warfare in the last 20 years, and you study all of the kinds of weapon systems that are being used offensively and defensively, it's an extremely elaborate field. Was it a surface-to-air missile? Was it a particular kind of a jamming transmitter? Was it a fooling transmitter? Was it a transmitter that transmitted phony command signals to the drone, which made it land or made it crash? The total number of ways you can defend yourself against modern weapon systems is a large number of ways. For you and I to sit here and say, oh, I know which one of the 10 ways it could have happened, and I know which one it was, and that's not that easy. The number of electronic countermeasures and counter-countermeasures techniques, the number of pieces of hardware that can be used for offense and defense is very large. So what brought down the drone? Did it run out of gas? I doubt it. Was it jammed? Was it hit with a surface-to-air missile? Was it given
the third factor at a certain point of the signal, which would be the third antenna, and part of the energy would be then feeded back at them. It reminds me what the community that I'm very much involved with.
Wes, I'm back up in your microphone a little bit. You're a little too close to that mic. Go ahead.
I believe that was better, right?
Tremendously better. Now I'm hearing more fidelity. You were so close, you were making square waves. Go ahead.
Okay, so, yeah, I wonder what would happen if we would be at the third antenna and the signal that was received by that antenna, we try to feed back to transmitter one of, transmitter the second one of. The funny things with it, it would be extremely entertaining. But I see in here a question that I have to ask. The community I'm pretty much involved with, when you get on the top, you actually learn that they laid a pump on other guys to get on the top of the technology. And the major factors to be blamed for whatever the successes is of the getting the energy out of supposed energy not existing medium.
Wes, you're going into another subject. We're answering John's email at this time. So I'll give you one piece of information you're starting to go through. You're asking what happened to a third antenna added to the mix. And that is a good phased array antenna might have...
Question about that.
A good phased array antenna might have 3 or 13 or 30 individual elements. That, if you look at my QSO card, if you Google the word TQLIW and you find that red QSO card, you'll see 16 individual gags of 13 elements each, 3 or 4 elements total.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you didn't understand. Okay, I'm going to keep it short.
And so, what you're going to see is 16 individual Yagi antennas, 304 elements altogether. If I had the right kind of electronics on board, I could have fed individual signals to the individual 16 Yagi antennas. If I did that, I would be generating something in the vicinity of 16 repeaters. To continue, I would have been developing 16 individual lobes in space with those 16 Yagi horizontally, 16 lobes in space vertically, or maybe it's 4x4, because we're 4 wide, 4 high, but that 16 individual Yagi really was a phased array. If I had 15 individual phase shifters by which I could change the phase angle of the signal I was feeding to those Yagi, I could be steering that beam in space. And to a small degree, I did do that. I put a bunch of relays into that antenna so that just by feeding power to all 16, to feeding power to one vertical string of 4 Yagi, or feeding power to one single Yagi, I generated 3 different antenna patterns, which I called the zoom control. If you look at the March issue 2008 of TQ Magazine, you see an article on that antenna by me, and you will see those antenna patterns. You will see that zoom control. In other words, I wrote way back in 1978 an extremely elaborate computer program that made three-dimensional antenna plots on a computer, and I had to modify a fancy rapidograph pen so I could just draw the darn antenna patterns without wearing out a felt-tip pen. The antenna pattern is so elaborate that when I drew all the lines on the page, an ordinary felt-tip pen on an XY plotter would get worn out. The pattern started looking, and the plot started looking sloppy, you know what I mean? So I had to do some fancy things to make those antenna patterns. March in 2008 issue, EQ Magazine, you'll see those three antenna patterns that I made out of that 16 Yagi phased array. You start adding more individual antennas. You got more and more steering capability of controlling. Is the beam going to be wide, narrow, horizontally, vertically, multiple lobes, steer to the left, steer to the right? Once you add electronic tuning controls to an antenna, all kinds of fancy things can happen. So what this question is really doing, John, Go ahead, John.
Well, Dick, I think you answered his question at the very beginning. Very good answer. His question, remember, was with one transmitter running, he roughly had 25 microvolts. And when he turned the second one on, he was looking to see 50 microvolts. Perfect answer. I think he understands the first, the three paragraphs that you stated. I think covered the subject that he was questioning. What Wesley's talking about, I don't know. That's not information for him, but, you know, good information also. But I think you covered it perfectly. Thank you, Dick.
Hi, John. What's your next question?
Okay, this is a tough one. All right. Guy has a 10 megahertz oscillator, one of the packets out of like an HP generator. What he wants to do, he has no exotic equipment. He wants to look at the 10 megahertz and the fundamentals and the overtones. Now, how can he do it, and what does he need as minimum to be able to do it? He doesn't have a spectrum analyzer. I know that would eliminate his problem, but is there any method he could use? Back to you, Dick.
In the case of a well-made
one, 2HF for the comment.
Lou recognized, and Lou, is your comment on the previous subject or this subject? NY2H, K2RAW, go ahead, Lou. NY2H, K2RAW, go ahead, Lou.
So, sir, is this Senator Devine, Pop, you're following me?
I'm hearing you now, Lou. Go ahead.
Yeah, but I didn't get on the air. What just occurred? Why are you calling me?
Okay. Somebody by EchoLink signed in saying NY2H with a comment. Are you telling me that wasn't you, Lou?
That was not me.
Because of the usual restrictions on EchoLink, that's a good one. Alrighty. When it comes to a well-designed piece of instrumentation, like a Hewlett-Packard frequency counter, frequency synthesizer, vector voltage, vector network analyzer, many of these have a so-called 10 megahertz reference oscillator. It's a crystal-controlled oscillator with oven control, and in many cases, it's got ridiculously high accuracy, and it's very carefully designed to have an extremely pure sine wave of 10 megahertz coming out of it. I don't know the exact spec. Let me drop.
Hey, Dick, I just opened up EchoLink. There's an NY2HF. So, very close. His name is Dennis. It must have been him.
Okay, we'll get over to Dennis in a minute. NY2HF. I didn't hear the F. What I'm getting at is that oscillator is very carefully designed to be extremely accurately on 10.000 megahertz, has very little aging, very little drift, once it comes up to full temperature with its internal oven. Its accuracy, its aging, everything is great. I would guess that that oscillator probably has harmonics coming out of it that are in the vicinity of 60 decibels suppressed. In other words, the harmonics out of that oscillator could very well be 1 millionth the power of the main 10 megacycle signal. To measure something 60 decibels down with a well-designed spectrum analyzer, pretty easy. Good spectrum analyzers nowadays have very little trouble displaying a second signal 70 dB down, in some cases 100 dB down, if things are carefully set. So a spectrum analyzer can do it. What's the difference between the fundamental and the harmonic of a smaller number, like 10 decibels, 20 decibels? You could use a tuned RF voltmeter. In other words, there's kinds of ham radio generated field strength meters. a dial on the front end, which allows you to use a built-in bandpass filter. Let me drop. Where you set the filter so that it passes the 10 megacycle signal, and you make a reference measurement to find out, you know, how far the needle deflects when it's set to 10 megs, and then you tune the tuning dial to 20 megs. And assuming that the filter is able to reject 10 megs by a whole lot of dB when it's tuned to 20 megs, then you'd be able to measure the second harmonic. But you got to be careful now. The second harmonic that you think you're measuring, is it really 20 or 30 megacycle energy, second or third harmonic, or are you looking at the skirt of the filter that's doing the tuning, that's doing the bandpass in front of your tunable RF voltmeter? So you got to be careful with that one. Many of those problems go away with the spectrum analyzer because you go through the proper calibration procedure. You know how far down of the skirt on the resolution filter that you're using. You're not going to be measuring a 10 meg and a 20 meg harmonic using a 3 megacycle wide resolution bandwidth filter on the spectrum analyzer. And some of them have it that wide. You're going to be making that measurement with a 100 KC filter, or maybe the 10 KC filter, which means you're a large number of bandwidth away on the undesired signal when you're measuring the desired signal on 20 or 30 meg. So a tunable RF voltmeter is a possibility if the number of decibels is small, but a well-designed oscillator where all the harmonics are 60 dB down, almost nothing but a spectrum analyzer is going to show that to me. In my opinion, John, KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, very good. I was wondering, the frequency selective voltmeters that HP makes, they can be pretty narrow. Might be able to get something like that reasonable, because I know they're almost as expensive as a spectrum analyzer. So that's the only other thing I know you might be able to use. They're pretty reliable and pretty tight. But yeah, that would be interesting because, as you're right when you say that they are very well built and they are very stable. I don't know why he's looking into the harmonics, but he must have some problem with that. Okay, very good, Dick. And I guess we can go over to Paul and get some space report. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
So I can turn over this guy. It's November Yankee 2 Hotel Foxtrot.
Okay, we'll go over to Dennis in a second. Even if at worst, your particular 10 megacycle reference oscillator had an undesired harmonic that was only 30 decibels down, and if your requirement was that it must be 60 decibels suppressed, for you to add a simple bandpass filter after the oscillator, which gives another 30 decibels of suppression of the second harmonic, and only half a dB of insertion loss on the fundamental, for you to add that simple LC network would be a very easy thing to do. So if in the worst case his oscillator failed to spec, it wouldn't take a heroic effort to make it meet whatever spec you got. You can add that filter, or you can find out what's wrong inside and making it generate a second harmonic. I don't recommend that, because many of these reference oscillators are a very sturdy, soldered together can, and you don't want to violate that. You don't want to take that apart unless it has completely failed. Dennis, NY2, Hotel Foxtrot, K2RIW, the tech man. Go right ahead, Dennis. My name is Dick. I can tell by the audio characteristic he was coming through by EchoLink or IRLP. He was coming out of the 146.85 machine for sure. Had a nice sounding signal. And he said NY2HF with a comment. I'll give him one more call. Dennis, NY2HF, question mark, K2RIW in the TechNet. Thank you. I knew last week there was a condition that you and I had emails back and forth on, where a person who normally listens to us from a remote area by either EchoLink or IRLP, one of those techniques, there was some kind of a lockout that occurred and he wasn't able to hear the TechNet. Want to give us a couple of words as to what happened, and is there some chance that Dennis is experiencing that at this time? NY2H, K2RIW, go ahead, Lou.
There's no problem. You've got up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You have 10 logged on now. You had 11 just before. Alan, who wrote the email last week, was on also, although he logged off now. We had some drawings from people who were attacking conference notes. And it was becoming a problem, so we locked that conference thing. Now, last week, I personally made an error. The lockout was a little bit too severe, and it was only letting one person in at a time. But we resolved that, so as they say, you have about 10 people in right now.
Very fine, Lou. And so you can be looking at the system and finding out what's going on. I can't do that. Turns out that my Linux-based computing system set up by my son, who is the computer maiden in the house, finds that there are certain incompatibilities with the kind of a program that has to be run to do that. And so until my machine gets updated, which is in the process of happening, I can't do that monitoring, and thank you for doing that. Are you sure that it's at least one more question we should be answering tonight, John? KC2WGB, KC2LIW in the TechNet.
Hello, let me just, I'm sorry to interrupt again, but I just did a QRZ, and John, this is Dennis from Cutchalk. I guess he changed his call. I did a QRZ, NY2HF is Dennis W. Lane in Cutchalk. Isn't that the Dennis that you guys speak to way out east, John?
Well, Dennis does live in Cutchalk. He lives on the northern fork, if that's Cutchalk, and he was LWI or something like that. That'll be the third call letter change. I'm surprised.
Yeah, there's more than one guy on the North Shore, on the North Fork, and they talk to each other and sometimes sign into the TechNet, and occasionally they sign in by RF. The propagation is proper. I'm kind of amazed at the... That's a very long distance that they're getting in. I think they're getting into the eastern input, but still it's a long distance. Anyone out there trying to sign in? You have your opportunity right now. Get your RIW in the second minute. And we did have an earlier sign-in for Hal, K6DTZ, and Bob, W2OSR. Both of which, when we got around to them, they weren't there. Is either one of you guys there yet? Yeah, when these guys closed down, they really closed down. So, once again, John, was there a third email that we should be going to, as opposed to letting them pile up, if you know what I mean? KC2WGB, K2LAW in the tech net.
Yes, I do, Dick. I do have a third one. And by the way, I don't know if you heard the news that NASA is dropping Microsoft's Windows system for their computers. They're going to the exact same computer system that you're using. They've tested it, run some beta tests, and that's their selection, so they're rewriting stuff right now. I didn't know if you were aware of that.
Yeah, that's new information to me, but it doesn't surprise me. A significant number of companies where their networking system within the company, the main base of the system is Linux-based as opposed to Windows-based, because one is a lot more secure than the other. When people write malware, they tend to write it for Windows-based systems. And for a bunch of reasons, they either don't or can't write it for Linux-based systems. So even though the individual program you're running on your desktop computer at your company looks like it's running a Windows program, sometimes the real network of the company itself is Linux-based because of its greatest with security and stability is what I'm hearing. Go ahead with your third one, John. KC2WGB, K2RLAW, the deck man.
Okay, Dick. I have basically two different people with really the same question. They want to do some antenna range work. They have a nice piece of property, a couple of acres, no trees. One is looking to check out a bow tie. This is all UHF, which is approximately a meter by a half a meter grid with the bow tie mounted on it. The other one is a corner reflector. And they want to know, basically, how should they set up to make those tests? A basic start, because I know this can really get involved, Dick, but I'm sure you can get them started on the right track. And both of these guys came in the same week with basically the same question. KC2WGB, over to you, Dick.
Yeah, when it comes to testing VHF and UHF antennas, 99% of the time you're going to do it on an outdoor antenna range. And an outdoor antenna range can be anything from extremely simple to quite elaborate. My recommendation for properly setting up an outdoor antenna range, if you want to make quantitative measurements of gain and pattern and front-to-back ratio and things like this, one of the best chapters to read is out of the ARRL antenna book, and the chapter or the section you should be reading is hidden away in a section you would never believe. You go to the ARRL antenna book under the subject of transmission lines and antenna measurements. Why they combine those two, I don't know. But in that chapter, transmission lines and antenna measurements, at the end of that chapter, you'll see the article by Dick Turin, W2IMU, as to the proper way of setting up an outdoor antenna range. Let me drop. And what's really going on here is the good news about an outdoor antenna range is it's nice and flat, and if you've got a big enough piece of property, it can be nice and long. That's the good news. The bad news is there is always, always ground reflection. And that ground reflection is one hell of a pain in the tail when it comes to antenna measurements, because the ground reflection is there when you don't want it to be there, and it's not constant. You start making measurements at 8 o'clock in the morning when there's lots of moisture on the first few inches of that soil, and you continue the measurements until the afternoon when the sun is baking the land is drying out, and the amount of ground reflection is changing, the phase angle of the ground reflection is changing, and you suddenly realize that, gee, I had this gain at 8 o'clock in the morning with the exact same setup at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I measured the same antenna, and I come up with a different number. And the answer is, the outer ground reflection changed in magnitude and phase angle. You have to live with it.